The Alphanut representative had guaranteed each order came with the name of a licensed physician who had written the prescription. Schultz's technicians noticed that often the doctors were based in Pennsylvania, but otherwise knew little about them and never spoke to them. Alphanut gave us copies of the physician licenses on file, and we attempted to monitor that patients were not getting more than the physicians approved, Schultz said. The pharmacy rarely interacted with online customers, aside from the occasional call about a refill gone missing, referred on to Alphanut customer service. For Schultz, the business was everything Alphanut had promised, and quickly relieved the pressures that had threatened his livelihood. His bank account began receiving wire transfers from a company called East Asia Escrow Limited in Hong Kong. Tens of thousands of dollars were pouring in monthly, and then weekly. Someone at the top of all this was clearly making tremendous amounts of money, Schultz thought. Who that might be, he didn't have the first idea. The Alphanut reps he talked to by phone, with names like Will Morris, Mike Gilmore, and Sam Kent, never said where they were located or how many people worked for the organization. Nor did they explain why the money came from East Asia Escrow or mention that Alphanut was another name for RX Limited. Even if they had, to Schultz it would have been just another faceless online company, one that, by 2008, was putting millions of dollars into his bank account. Alphanut said that its operation was legal and legitimate, Schultz said. I wanted to believe them. At the same moment Schultz was finding financial salvation at the end of his career, Dr. Prabhakara Tempati was seeking some at the beginning of his. In 2008, Tempati had just finished his residency at Abington Memorial Hospital in suburban Philadelphia and was entering the medical field in the middle of a recession. Tempati's road to becoming a doctor had been nothing short of extraordinary. He was born into a farming family in the remote Indian village of M. Nagalapalli, and his first few years of education had taken place in a local school with a dirt floor and no electricity. Tempati had a Hindu father and a Christian mother, an unusual combination in that part of India, and they had raised him Christian. His maternal grandmother had converted after his mother suffered a grave childhood illness. The family believed she had been cured after a villager suggested the grandmother pray to Jesus. Faith would lead to providence in Tempati's own life, too. At the suggestion of a local pastor, Tempati applied to a children's boarding school several villages away, run by an Indian-American missionary physician from Pennsylvania. From there, Tempati's intellectual abilities and his relentless work ethic carried him to a top-flight Indian medical school, postgraduate work in Norway, and an internal medicine residency at Abington Memorial in the United States. That he landed in the state from which his own missionary childhood teacher hailed only confirmed for Tempati the power of God's works. Now, though, he was fully trained and trying to find his way in the American workforce. His son had been born the year before, and with another baby on the way, he and his wife decided she should quit her job as a computer programmer and stay home with the kids. That left it to Tempati to cover all of their expenses, including the mortgage on a new house. Straight out of residency, he took on two part-time medical jobs, one as an associate doctor at an internal medicine clinic started by a friend, the other at a company where he reviewed drug test results from patients around the country. As soon as he felt he had both jobs under control, he started looking for even more work. Tempati had always considered himself tech-savvy. Back when he had been accepted for residency, an arduous process that was particularly daunting for overseas students, he'd created an online forum called residencecafe.com, where he answered questions for medical school graduates about the residency matching system. The site grew to over 6,000 registered users. He'd also created a site called wikimd.org, a Wikipedia-like medical encyclopedia maintained by volunteers. So when looking for work, he naturally gravitated online. On a forum titled Physicians Worked From Home, he saw a posting for a role with a company called RX Limited. When Tempati replied to the posting, a company representative using the name Aaron Johnson laid out the job for him. Tempati would review medical questionnaires from patients who had ordered drugs on a website, and if warranted, prescribe them the drugs they were requesting. Tempati was familiar with the concept of telemedicine, a burgeoning field in which medical practitioners use the internet to interact with patients. RX Limited's model struck him as cutting edge, an extension of the remote medicine he was already practicing by reviewing test results. It also paid by the prescription, $2 for each one he issued. Whatever misgivings Tempati might have had about the process, representatives of RX Limited worked to assuage them, assuring him that they had over 40 other physicians doing this and that it is fully valid and legal, he said. They assured me that they only deal with non-DEA-controlled substances and that these patients already have annual physical examinations with their own physicians. He signed up. Rx Limited sent him login credentials for a website where he could access the customer questionnaires and orders. He would examine a patient's responses, click a box to mark the order accepted or rejected, and move on to the next. For a doctor, the work couldn't have been more simple. There were no waiting rooms full of patients to deal with, no insurance forms to fill out. Tempati assumed that Rx Limited's customers already had a diagnosis in hand and were just looking for affordable refills on medications they had been prescribed. It appeared to me to be a perfect opportunity not only to serve a lot of patients, he said, but also be able to do so in my free time. It was also, it turned out, extremely lucrative for a part-time job. Soon he was making enough money not just to cover his expenses, but to save up to start his own practice. And more important, he was able to send some of it back home to sponsor kids at the same missionary school that had given him a pathway out of his village. 1,000 miles apart, Tempati and Schultz had no sense that their worlds were now connected. They were merely nodes on a vast network of another man's creation, each unable to see beyond the limits of his own attachment point. Neither paid any special notice to a request transmitted across that network on August 27, 2008. It arrived first to Tempati, an order from a customer named Sarah Johnson, placed on a website called cheaprxmeds.net, then bounced through Rx Limited systems to Tempati's screen. The order was for 90 pills of Fioricet, retail price $170. On the medical questionnaire Tempati glanced at for no more than a few seconds, Johnson had listed the reason for her purchase as migraine, the condition for which Fioricet was usually prescribed. Tempati marked it approved and moved on, as it was uploaded back into the digital ether. Hours later, after a virtual trip from Canada to Israel to the Philippines and back, the order arrived on a computer at Charles Schultz's Medicine Mart in Monroe, Wisconsin. There, a technician saw the prescription and queued it for filling. A white-coated pharmacist pulled down a green bottle, smoothed on a label bearing Tempati's name, slid the exact number of oblong pills inside, and dropped the bottle into a FedEx envelope. The pre-printed label was addressed to a FedEx office mailbox in Minneapolis, down the street from the DEA. Chapter 3. The Reporter. 2013 to 2015. Rambo gets arrested. Murder and North Korean methamphetamine. The mysterious Paul LaRue. Lost in the data. A lawyer and a deal. Today we announce the arrest of Joseph Hunter, said Preet Bharara, the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, standing at a podium in a dark suit and patterned tie on the morning of September 27, 2013. Photographers snapped away in the front row briefing room in downtown Manhattan. Television cameras in the back broadcast Bharara's press conference live for the international news. The bone-chilling allegations in today's indictment read like they were ripped from the pages of a Tom Clancy novel, Bharara said. The charges tell a tale of an international band of mercenary marksmen who enlisted their elite military training to serve as hired guns for evil ends. That morning, a federal court had unsealed an indictment outlining precisely what those evil ends were. Hunter, a 48-year-old decorated U.S. Army veteran, stood accused of organizing an international hit squad composed of ex-soldiers from the United States, Poland, and Germany. Their mission? To carry out the murder of a DEA agent and his informant on behalf of a Colombian drug cartel for a price of $800,000. Today's arrests, Bharara said, are the culmination of a bold and brave global investigation conducted by some of the most extraordinary law enforcement agents in the world, the men and women of the DEA's Special Operations Division. The Thai police had captured Hunter 2 days before at a safe house on a golf course in Phuket, Thailand. Two members of Hunter's assassination squad had been picked up at the same time in Liberia as they prepared to carry out the hit. The fourth and fifth were caught in Estonia, charged with providing security for a drug shipment to the United States. All five would be extradited to New York to stand trial. The announcement made international headlines, not least because Hunter's actual nickname, according to prosecutors, was Rambo. When I read about it in the news the next morning, I couldn't disagree with Bharara's flash of showmanship. The whole thing did sound as if it were concocted by a novelist. Curious if there was more to the story, I went online and downloaded the indictment. Paging through it, I discovered that if the allegations read like fiction, it was in part because, in some sense, they were. The whole thing, the murder for hire of the DEA agent, the drug deal, had been an elaborate setup, a version of what's known as a reverse sting operation. The two people that Hunter and his crew were plotting to murder never existed. They were inventions of the DEA, who laid an elaborate trap for Hunter's crew, enticing them into plotting a crime against imaginary victims. Most of the case had been sealed by a federal judge, but the indictment described a world of amoral mercenaries operating with utter impunity, arranging paid assassinations without a second thought. On recordings made by the DEA, using microphones hidden in the Phuket safe house, Hunter was captured preparing his team to carry out jobs for the supposed Colombians, including killings for hire that he referred to as bonus work. "This is real stuff," he told his team. "You see James Bond in the movie and you're saying, 'Oh, I can do that?' Well, you're going to do it now." He bragged about the kind of bonus work he'd done in the past, or paid others to do, including, the indictment noted, arranging for the murder of two female real estate agents. The sting operation seemed to have taken a heinous character off the street, but I kept wondering, what had put the DEA on to Hunter in the first place? Was the agency randomly tossing out fishing lines around the world, advertising assassinations hoping that someone would bite? Or had they come across Hunter and targeted him specifically? Then the story grew even stranger. 2 months after the press conference, in November 2013, the Southern District announced another dramatic bust. This time, it was of a group of suspects planning to import huge quantities of North Korean-made methamphetamine into the United States. Again, the arrest stemmed from a sting operation set up by the DEA, using fake members of a Colombian cartel. Again, some of the arrests were made in Phuket. Again, much of the case was sealed, shielding it from the public eye. And yet the U.S. Department of Justice again seemed eager to make a big splash. "Methamphetamine is a dangerous, potentially deadly drug, whatever its origin," Barrera said in a press release. "If it ends up in our neighborhoods, the threat it poses to public health is grave, whether it is produced in New York, elsewhere in the U.S., or in North Korea." I was struck by the bizarre set of circumstances shared by the two cases and kept poring over the sketchy information contained in the indictments. Neither made mention of the other, but each referred to an unnamed person involved in the sting, labeled variously as a narcotics trafficking partner and Individual One, who appeared to be a cooperating witness. Whether this was the same mysterious figure in the two cases was impossible to tell, but both groups had been arrested on the same day in Thailand and were being prosecuted by exactly the same U.S. attorneys. A few days later, the Washington Post quoted an unnamed DEA source claiming a link between Hunter and North Korea, but nobody seemed to follow up. As I dug into the case myself, I started to understand why. I barely got below the surface before I hit what seemed to be a layer of impenetrable rock. I knew from experience that the DEA was rarely interested in talking about open cases, and these two were no exception. "I'm sorry, Evan, there isn't any information we can confirm, deny, or discuss right now, unfortunately," a DEA spokesperson replied when I contacted him. Defense lawyers often leap to proclaim their clients' innocence, but most of the attorneys in the two cases were unwilling to comment at all. Others would only meet in person, outside their office, and talk off the record. One lawyer I called just happened to pick up his office phone one afternoon. He'd left the case, he told me, and didn't want to discuss it. I kept him on the line long enough to ask about the mysterious Individual One at the center of the case. He laughed. "Oh, you mean Kaiser Soze?" he said, referring to the elusive master criminal at the center of the film The Usual Suspects. Then he referred me to the new lawyer on the case and hung up. That lawyer never responded to my inquiries. And then, suddenly, a name. It came in late 2014, in a leak from an anonymous official at the DEA to a New York Times reporter named Alan Foyer, who was covering the federal courthouse where Hunter was to be tried. Individual One, the official revealed, was a South African named Paul Calder LaRue, a computer programmer and some kind of international cartel boss. The DEA official called LaRue Victor Boot on steroids, a reference to the notorious global arms dealer who had been prosecuted by the Southern District of New York back in 2011. LaRue, in the anonymous official's telling, was a computer genius who had built an empire selling prescription drugs over the internet, and then leveraged that fortune into international crimes, from arms trafficking to contract murder. He was also the man who connected Joseph Hunter and his hit team to the crew smuggling meth out of North Korea. All of the figures involved had worked not for Hunter, but for LaRue. And now it seemed LaRue had turned against them and was helping the government run them down. For a brief moment, it seemed that the mystery I'd been chasing had been solved. But after a few weeks, the headlines disappeared again, obscured by news of a terrorist attack in France and by the first moves of a presidential race that would end in the election of Donald Trump. LaRue's existence receded into the shadows with the most important questions unanswered. Namely, where did he come from, and how had a South African computer programmer managed to create his own global cartel? Why had the government refused to release his identity and then suddenly leaked it? And where was he now? I became obsessed with finding out. As I tried to page back through LaRue's history, his story at first seemed borderless, almost limitless. I spent the better part of a year trying to understand him through the same means by which he directed his pharmacy business, the internet. Late at night, after my wife went to bed and then, as time went on, while my newborn daughter slept, I would open my laptop and plunge into a thicket of data. The first hints of LaRue were faint, puzzling. Here was his name on a Florida company cited in a 2008 Federal Communications Commission complaint about a marketing call made to someone on the National Do Not Call registry. There was his email address, connected to a gun dealer in Manila called Red, White, and Blue Arms. Here, lodged in a Hong Kong company database, was LaRue establishing Net Trading LTD in 2006, before changing its name to Ajax Technology in 2008, then transferring the ownership to someone named Robson Tendenai. There was LaRue, incorporating another Ajax Technology in the United Kingdom in 2006, with a Dutch address, before again gifting the company to Tendenai. Each piece of data seemed to lead to a dozen more, until I began to feel like I was engaged in an elaborate version of the children's game Concentration. I would find one clue, stash it away, and hope to turn over another that matched it later on. Unbeknownst to me, I was often flipping many of the same cards that Brill and Holdren had, a half dozen years before. Like them, I started uncovering websites related to Rx Limited, LaRue's prescription pill empire, first a few, then hundreds, then thousands. Their registration seemed to switch over the years from addresses in the Philippines to the United States, to other countries, and back. Many of them connected to a single location, Unit 1401 BDO Building, Paseo de Rojas, Makati City, in Manila's upscale shopping and business district. A search on that address, in turn, matched the location of call centers in the Philippines, with names like Call Extreme, Dial Magic, and Global INET Bridge. Soon my digital files were stuffed with thousands of these interconnected nodes, spread across the United States, Panama, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Romania, Russia, and the Philippines. I found dozens of LaRue-connected companies, with names as inscrutable to me as Paul LaRue himself. Southern Ace, La Plata Trading, GX Port, Everplus, SciComm Tech, Wilex, East Asia Escrow, Martinius Trading, MTCL, Quantcom Commerce, Vishnu Limited, Century Holdings, Amana Holdings, BN Pay, Alpha Networks, Dyco Limited, Maximum 8. It seemed almost impossible that one person could have a hand in it all. One night in October 2015, I was exploring the possible connections to an email address I'd found for LaRue, plarue@swprofessionals.com, from a defunct software company called SW Professionals. The same address, I discovered, turned up in the instruction manual for a piece of encryption software called Encryption for the Masses, or E4M. The software was designed to protect a computer's files from the prying eyes of law enforcement and the government. I looked up the old website for E4M and discovered that it had been controlled by an Australian company called World Away Pty. On the corporate registration for World Away, its owner was listed as a Zimbabwean named Paul Calder LaRue. E4M was long since out of use, but its code had formed the basis of a more famous encryption program, among the most famous file encryption programs, called TrueCrypt. The favored software of everyone from national security whistleblower Edward Snowden to the terrorist group ISIS, TrueCrypt had itself long been a mystery. Its developers were anonymous. Now it appeared as if LaRue, at least indirectly, had a hand in it. The implications were bewildering. LaRue wasn't just a thug who'd clawed his way to the top of an organization, nor was he simply the clever architect of an online pill network. This was a man smart enough to create technology that the U.S. government's elite hackers couldn't crack. By late 2015, I was awash in information about Paul LaRue, but ultimately my lists of names and companies didn't cohere into a picture of his organization. Fortunately, there was another legal case connected to LaRue, targeting his prescription drug network. In Minneapolis, a grand jury had indicted 11 Rx Limited employees and associates in 2014, and several of them were out on bail, awaiting trial. Why Minneapolis? I had no idea. But at the very least, the case would give me another set of lawyers to call. As expected, the prosecutors from the Department of Justice declined to talk. That October, one defense attorney finally picked up the phone. His name was Joe Friedberg, and he was perhaps the Twin Cities' best-known defense lawyer. Friedberg and another heavy-hitting attorney, Robert Richman, had taken on the case of an Israeli citizen named Moran Oz, one of the 11 defendants in the Arx Limited case. According to his indictment, Moran Oz, a.k.a. Ron Oz, a.k.a. Ron Martin, was an Arx Limited associate who resided in Israel and managed day-to-day operations for and communications with Arx Limited Fulfillment Pharmacies. Oz was facing 83 counts of mail fraud, wire fraud, and unlawful distribution of controlled substances. The indictment described him as a key player in a massive network delivering millions of doses of addictive painkillers to American homes. "I can't give you very much information that would help you," Friedberg told me at first. "This is a very strange case." He, like me, was baffled about the black hole that seemed to surround Paul LaRue. "The government doesn't want to tell us anything," he said. "They have all these people indicted, and they don't have the guy indicted who owned it and started it. We'd at least like to know where he is and where he's been." The government's prosecutor, a D.C.-based attorney named Linda Marks, had proven equally unhelpful. Why the case was being prosecuted out of D.C., rather than by federal prosecutors in Minneapolis, was another mystery. Marks had told the defense attorneys, Friedberg said on our call, that she had no idea where LaRue was. I hung up having learned little more than I already knew. A week later, Friedberg called back with a proposal. "Typically, I would not let a client speak to the press before their trial," he told me, "but the defense team was operating so deeply in the dark that they were prepared to take a gamble. They would let me interview Oz on the condition that I not quote him by name before his trial, which was then scheduled for 7 months later, in June 2016. Their hope was that I could follow leads Oz might generate for me, then publish information that would inform their case. A few weeks later, I landed in Minneapolis and checked into a room at a downtown hotel, connected to Friedberg's building by one of the city's habitrail-like overhead tunnels. When he walked into the conference room the next morning, Friedberg exuded the witty charm that had served him well in some of the most high-profile criminal cases in the city. Richman arrived soon after, seeming quiet and reserved alongside his gregarious partner. But Richman had taken on much of the heavy lifting for the upcoming trial. "This case is extraordinary," he said, as we sat down across from each other at a long wooden table. "There are a million documents and probably tens of millions of pages, so many that they'd had to contract with a private company to organize them into a database." Oz arrived a few minutes later. He was trim and stylish, in his early 30s, with a dark beard and yarmulke. For a man facing an 80-plus count federal indictment, he radiated a natural calmness. Only a small electronic bracelet wrapped around his ankle, half covered by the cuff of his designer jeans, gave any indication of his situation. He spent a few minutes discussing the logistics of his court-ordered supervision with Richman and Friedberg. Stranded in Minneapolis now for a year and a half, he relied on the generosity of a local Jewish community, which had loaned him an apartment and a car. Then he sat down across from me and told me his story from the beginning. Chapter 4. The Operators. 2005 to 2008. Moran Oz and Alon Berkman get to work. A new boss appears. A trip to Manila. The pipeline opens. Moran Oz grew up in Jerusalem, the sort of kid that everyone seems to remember fondly. The smart and curious son of a successful CPA and a dance teacher, he breezed through school. The guy who could miss class and then waltz in and get an A, as one childhood friend described him. His only flirtations with trouble stemmed from his devotion to Beitar Jerusalem, an Israeli soccer team known for its unruly supporters. In February 2005, Oz had just graduated from high school and completed his compulsory service in the Israeli army. He was visiting an uncle in New York, wondering what to do with his life, go to college, start a business, when a friend called to say that an acquaintance had launched a startup in Israel and was looking to hire. The only requirements were a good command of English and a basic understanding of computers. Oz flew home and took the job. The man who hired him was named Boaz Taggart. He'd started the company, a call center called Beit Oridan, with his brother Tomer, who lived in the United States. The term call center was a bit of a misnomer, since much of their work happened over email, but such companies typically consisted of banks of cubicles, filled with employees fielding customer service inquiries. In this case, Beit Oridan was part of a larger organization, a network of websites that went by the names Rx Limited and AlphaNet, and sold prescription drugs to American consumers over the internet. In 2005, when Oz began working there, the company had 8 American pharmacies operating in the network, taking 8,000 orders a week. It was growing quickly, with a recruitment arm that advertised for doctors on online forums like Craigslist, and solicited by fax and phone the kind of independent pharmacies too small to build an online presence themselves. Within a few months of Oz's arrival, the number of employees doubled. Among the new hires was a slight, nervous man named Alon Berkman. Berkman's primary responsibility, at least at first, was to provide support for affiliate marketers, independent websites that advertised drugs through email and search engines, and then referred customers back to Rx Limited for a 60% cut of every order. Bet Oridan's employees were instructed to adopt American-sounding names and say they were located in Utah. Oz's handle was Ron Martin. Berkman's was Alan Berkman. Oz's job as operations manager didn't require any knowledge of pharmaceuticals, nor of the technological infrastructure behind Rx Limited. He arrived each morning, quickly reviewed the prescriptions uploaded by doctors in the United States, then clicked a few buttons to send them on to one of Rx Limited's pharmacies, allocating orders according to each store's daily capacity. The rest of the staff was responsible for recruiting and communicating with doctors and pharmacists, and for customer support, dealing with password problems, lost shipments, expired credit cards, and incomplete questionnaires. New hires were supplied with a pitch, a standard script that told them how to respond to various customer complaints. The majority of them were technical issues, one former call center worker said. There were regulations that we had to be aware of in terms of people using certain drugs. The company also maintained a fraud team, like any legitimate online retailer. If an order was deemed suspicious, we were immediately instructed to send them up to the fraud team, the former worker said. And if people had lost packages, we were to refer them to UPS or FedEx. To the extent that he ever considered the legality of the whole operation, Oz felt that Rx Limited was working hard to comply with a confusing tangle of state and federal prescription drug laws in the United States. For instance, a database held the order history for every customer and tracked the dates and amounts of their last purchases. If a new order showed up more quickly than a drug should have been consumed, the system was supposed to prevent that customer from getting a refill. The company did at times encounter what Oz and his colleagues thought of as regulatory hitches. If a state changed its rules to ban the shipment of a certain drug, the system had to be adjusted to stop sending orders to pharmacies in that state. Occasionally, Oz would hear about American pharmacies being inspected by their state pharmacy board. They might go offline for a few days, then reappear in the system. But since the company didn't deal in controlled substances, Oz was told that the law was not an issue. When prospective pharmacies complained about their cut of each prescription, $2 or $3, the pharmacy recruiters were prepared with their own script. The reason we pay so low is that we are doing a legal business, they were told to say. If you're getting $10, you should save it for your bail because that means what you're doing is illegal. Boaz and Tomer Taggart told their employees that they had a third silent partner in the business, a programmer Tomer had met after posting an ad in an online forum. But Bet Oridan's staff knew little about him, other than that he handled the technical infrastructure of the company, part of which he outsourced to contractors in Romania. To Oz, the setup didn't seem out of keeping with the call center industry. The Taggart brothers ran the day-to-day operations without drama. That is, until July 2006, when Oz returned from a vacation to discover that Boaz had been ousted from the business with no explanation. Tomer took sole control, running the operation predominantly from the United States. Boaz's departure did nothing to slow the company's growth. As the staff ballooned, Oz and Berkman recruited friends to work with them, extolling the flexible shifts and salaries generally about 15% higher than other call center jobs in Israel. Then, one afternoon in 2007, a chat message popped up on Moran Oz's computer screen. "I'm your boss now. From now on, you report to me." The message came from one Paul LaRue, a name Oz had never heard before. He could reasonably infer that LaRue was the rumored third partner. It was less clear why, without explanation or pleasantries, he had suddenly reached out. "I have to talk to Tomer," Oz responded. LaRue told him that Tomer was out. Oz immediately called Taggart, who confirmed that he was stepping aside for his formerly silent partner, a South African programmer living in the Philippines. When Oz asked him why, he said only that he had been working too hard and wanted to see his kids grow up. The whole thing was unnerving, but Oz wasn't eager to jump ship. At first, the management change did little to alter the atmosphere in Jerusalem, where the company had grown to 20 people. Oz and Berkman were now essentially running the operation, both making good money. What difference did it make who signed the checks? LaRue conducted almost all his business over email in the company's chat system, in a gruff style devoid of small talk. He didn't joke, and he never asked questions about the lives of his employees or offered up any information regarding his own. He was more concerned about security than Boaz or Tomer had been, insisting that Oz and Berkman encrypt their hard drives, but otherwise, as far as Oz was concerned, a boss was a boss. A few months later, LaRue announced that he wanted to meet Oz and Berkman in person, in the Philippines. They flew business class via Hong Kong to Manila. A driver fetched them from the airport and deposited them at a luxury condo located next to a synagogue. That night, they met LaRue for the first time at the Hard Rock Cafe in a mall in Makati City, in central Manila. They had little idea what to expect. They'd been unable to find any photos of, or even references to, their boss online. When he arrived, they immediately noted his size. LaRue was rotund and lumbering, around 6 feet tall, with an enormous head and the bearing of a man who didn't regret his bulk. More striking than his size was the slovenly dress of their supposedly high-rolling boss. As nearly all employees who met LaRue face-to-face discovered, he rarely deviated from a uniform of shorts, t-shirt, and flip-flops. His employees often mocked LaRue's appearance behind his back, not realizing how he played it to his advantage, disarming expectations. "I'm not saying he looks like that on purpose," one employee later said. But nobody has ever thought the first time they meet him that he runs a global criminal empire. He was in his late 30s but looked younger, his short hair dyed an unnatural blonde. To Oz, he seemed affable enough in person, in an offensive sort of way. "These Jews can't eat any of this," LaRue joked with the waitress. "Just get them some chips." When it came to business, however, LaRue projected confidence and control. He explained to Oz and Berkman that he'd originally based the company in the Philippines in 2004 to avoid taxes. Once there, he discovered the country's thriving call center business and started one for RX Limited called Dial Magic to cold call potential customers, enticing them to go online and order prescriptions from RX Limited sites. He groused about his difficulty in finding competent managers. The locals were monkeys who couldn't handle the responsibility. Now, with his operation expanding, he wanted Oz and Berkman to find job candidates in Israel who would transfer to Manila. That, it seemed, was the extent of what LaRue had needed to discuss with the pair in person. Oz and Berkman flew home with recruitment added to their duties. Finding Israelis willing to move to the Philippines proved easy enough. Many of Bet Oriadan's employees were young and single, and keen for an adventure in a country where their salary would go twice as far. The first few transplants didn't take, however. "We sent three managers," Oz said. "One was just to establish the customer service center, renting the location, creating all the infrastructure. After a month, he came back. The second one was the same. It didn't work out. I didn't know why." Finally, Oz and Berkman sent Levi Kugel, a blonde Israeli-American whose first love was playing guitar and who had been hired by Berkman in Jerusalem. Soon after Kugel arrived in Manila, word came back to Oz that they'd found the kind of manager that LaRue had been seeking. "It was love at first sight," Oz said. Levi was calling the shots in the Philippines after a short time. From there, the Israel to Philippines pipeline rapidly expanded, fueling LaRue's exploding call center business. "My understanding was that this was all legal," said Yehuda Ben-Dor, an Israeli-American whose experience typified many of the Israelis. "There was nothing fishy about it." Ben-Dor had been living in Tel Aviv when he answered an ad for work in the call center run by Oz and Berkman. He took the job, moved up to manager, and then was asked if he wanted to run a call center in the Philippines. The thing with Paul's company was that the attrition rate was pretty high. People come and go, and he was always looking for new people. I was the next guy, so to speak. I didn't know anything about the Philippines at that time. Within a few days of arriving in Manila, Ben-Dor found himself overseeing 10 call centers with more than 1,000 employees. The epicenter of LaRue's business was located on the 14th floor of the BDO building, a shimmering glass tower in Makati. The open office was an expanse of connected desks, with 50 to 60 Filipino representatives sitting side by side on headsets, hustling to earn a $2 or $3 commission on each drug sale. On the wall was a large map of the United States, individual states labeled with the drugs that could be shipped to and from each. Most employees rarely saw or heard from LaRue. Ben-Dor said that in nearly 2 years working for him, he saw his boss only a handful of times and remembered the first time clearly. "He called me up and asked me to just come on over to his condo," Ben-Dor said. There he found LaRue sitting alone at a desk in a massive, largely empty space flanked by racks of servers. LaRue dispensed with greetings. "How's it going?" he asked. "Good," Bendor told him. He began rattling off numbers, eager to prove that the call centers were performing well. LaRue cut him off. "Well, let me know if you need anything," he said. Bendor's first meeting with the boss, who had moved him to the Philippines, housed him, and placed him in charge of 1,000 people, had lasted 5 minutes. "You called me all the way over here to tell me that?" he said. "Yeah," LaRue told him. "I just wanted to meet you." LaRue continued to stay away from Israel, but occasionally requested to speak face-to-face with Oz and Berkman on important topics. In October 2008, he ordered the pair back to Manila for a second meeting. This time he informed them that he would be expanding his operations in Israel. The business was growing faster than his Philippine centers could handle, and he wanted Oz and Berkman to open a new call center in Tel Aviv. "It's time to take responsibility," LaRue told them, before sending them home to begin hiring immediately. "Money," he said, "is not an issue." Chapter 5. The Investigators. 2008. Operation Checkmate slows to a crawl. LaRue all the way down. Tracking a ghost, a tip from Hong Kong, a river of money. Operation Checkmate was proving much more like a chess match than Kimberly Brill and Stephen Holdren had originally anticipated, drawn out, with attacks and counters, and an opponent thinking several moves ahead. Sitting in their respective cubicles, in the Minneapolis DEA's diversion unit, they combed through what felt like endless dumps of data, company filings, shipping records, website registrations, and filled government-issue 5x7 notebooks with charts and lines, trying to arrange the scraps of what they found into a narrative. By mid-2008, RX Limited was essentially their full-time job. "We just went at it from start of shift till the end," Holdren said. And after the end, too. At home, the case rattled around in their brains. Brill often found herself back at her laptop long after she put her two young children to bed, plotting out strategy and making late-night calls to time zones around the world. The deeper they immersed themselves into RX Limited's operation, the more elaborate the technical architecture they found, and the more calculating the people, or person, behind it began to seem. As months and then years passed, Brill and Holdren kept ordering drugs. Controlled buys, they knew, would anchor any eventual prosecution. They were struck by how easy it was. RX Limited websites operated like any online store. Customers placed the drugs they wanted into a virtual shopping cart, and then checked out. They filled out the surveys with whatever came to mind and paid with real credit cards. Unlike on the more anonymous layers of the internet that would later become known as the dark web, customers didn't require any special software or online currency to buy drugs. 2 days later, the box would arrive. But there was one quirk to the system. The investigators noticed that when Brill's alter ego Sarah Johnson checked out at an RX Limited site like SpeedyRx.com, her browser suddenly redirected, or switched locations, to another site called cartadmin.com. The same thing happened on every other RX Limited-related site. In programming parlance, cartadmin.com and a second site called systemca.com constituted the back end of the RX Limited system, the part that processed transactions. These sites, Brill and Holdren realized, were what linked hundreds of RX Limited affiliate websites together. If an affiliate used cartadmin.com or systemca.com as its back end, Brill and Holdren now knew that it belonged to LaRue. To understand what this all added up to, the investigators had to travel well past the limits of their DEA training and plunge into the technical thicket of the internet. Their case against LaRue would be built in part on an understanding of the internet's basic architecture, namely that every computer connected to the network and every website hosted on it is assigned a unique number called an Internet Protocol, or IP address. When Brill typed cartadmin.com into a browser, her request traveled to a domain name server, the Internet equivalent of a telephone directory, which spent a fraction of a second looking up cartadmin.com and returning an IP address for its location. The Internet's directories are managed, in turn, by an international body called ICANN, short for the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. ICANN controls the distribution of IP addresses and accredits companies called domain name registrars to sell unique website names like cartadmin.com and keep records of who owns them. All these technical minutiae were about to become critical to Brill and Holdren's understanding of LaRue. Using an open source service called Domain Tools, they conducted background checks on the websites connected to RX Limited, tracing their IP addresses and the histories of who had registered them and where. The backend sites, cardadmin.com and systemca.com, traced to a domain registrar operating in the Philippines called AB Systems. That, in and of itself, wasn't particularly illuminating. ICANN accredits registrars all over the world. But there was something off about AB Systems. For one thing, the company didn't seem to offer a way for the public to actually purchase domains. AB Systems' own webpage was empty, except for a login page. Wondering what other websites were connected to the company, the investigators flipped around their search, querying domain tools for every site registered through AB Systems. The list was astonishing. rx24usa.com, rx2uusa.com, rx4discountusa.com, rxbilling.com, rxcheckoutusa.com, rxdrugstoremeds.com, rxdrugstoreusa.com, and hundreds more. It was an endless variation of drug-related domain names. Almost every website registered to AB Systems was an online pharmacy, and nearly every affiliate Brill and Holdren had connected to RX Limited could be found on the list. At first, they assumed that RX Limited must somehow be collaborating with AB Systems. The agents issued a subpoena to ICANN and received a pile of documents outlining everything the organization knew about it. The company was based at an address in Manila on the 14th floor of the BDO building in Makati City, the same address as RX Limited's main call center. The name on the account was LaRue's. Staring at the records, they finally understood why that name had kept popping up and how RX Limited maintained so many prescription drug sites. RX Limited and AB Systems weren't collaborating. They were one and the same, and they were both creations of Paul LaRue. He wasn't buying website domains. He was minting them himself, by the thousands. He had built what the corporate world would call a fully integrated vertical business, a structure in which he controlled every layer from top to bottom, and hijacked the very architecture of the internet to do it. The technical acumen behind it was frightening. "We knew he was a legitimate drug kingpin," Holdren said. "He wasn't a low-level or mid-level guy that we were trying to turn into something bigger. We knew he was the real deal, and he was a genius to put this all together." To build a case that could be prosecuted, though, Brill and Holdren needed more than just an understanding of LaRue's brilliance. They needed to establish how the whole thing broke American laws, and then link it to the undercover buys being delivered to their nearby FedEx mail drop. Much of the information the investigators had gathered so far, like the FedEx records requests, required only so-called administrative subpoenas, which the DEA could issue without a court order. Now it was time to go get search warrants. Poring over the list of domain names controlled by AB Systems, they noticed one non-pharmaceutical website, e4m.net, the home of LaRue's encryption software in the early 2000s. A search on the site's history turned up another email address for LaRue, paulca@rocketmail.com. Brill and Holdren, with the help of a federal prosecutor in Minneapolis, convinced a judge to sign off on a warrant for Rocketmail, owned by the internet giant Yahoo. The warrant enabled them to capture the previous 30 days' worth of messages from the account. The emails confirmed their suspicion that LaRue was directing every aspect of the business, making arrangements with credit card processors, manipulating a web of international bank accounts, and using other people's identities to register shell companies around the world. But many of the threads led to yet another email account, plarue@server73.net. There, the trail went cold. Server73.net, unlike a Gmail or Hotmail account, wasn't a commercial email service to which the investigators could send warrants. Instead, it was a private, secure email program that Paul LaRue appeared to have built himself, much as he had built AB Systems. The investigators had no way to tap into it. "Every time we turned a corner, he controlled every aspect of this," Holdren said. Fortunately, not all of LaRue's employees were so sophisticated or so cautious. Many of his correspondents were using commercial addresses, and eventually Brill and Holdren obtained warrants on more than 20 separate email accounts. Each produced hundreds and sometimes thousands of messages to sort through. One particular address, ronoz11@hotmail.com, seemed to be a hub for communications with many of the pharmacies, and the investigators concluded that it belonged to the primary operations manager for RX Limited, a man who went by the names Ron Martin and Ron Oz. The Oz email address and several others, including ones under the names Levy Kugel and Alon Berkman, traced to Israel, where the investigators determined LaRue was running a customer service center for RX Limited. Most of Oz's email traffic involved problems with shipments, questions about pricing, and other routine correspondence with doctors and pharmacies, eager to expand the number of orders they prescribed and shipped. Oz's responses evinced what appeared to Brill and Holdren to be a detailed knowledge of American law, and he was careful to assert the legality of the operation in writing. "We are happy to know you are interested in joining us in our company," he wrote to a pharmacist in mid-2008. "All products are non-controlled and can only ship to states where our business type is legal. For example, we do not work with Florida, Kentucky, Nevada, and Arkansas at all, due to local state laws." "I really love filling these RXs," one pharmacist wrote to Oz, explaining that he had a paralyzed son to support. "If this is going to be a long-term thing, I need to get the RXs faster off the computer. I read on your site that this partner filling is 100% legal and we follow all the rules of the filler's state. I hope that is true. Is it?" "Of course, it is 100% legal. We are in this business for 4 years," Oz replied. "We are not filling controlled. Please stop sending so many emails." While Brill and Holdren were knee-deep in IP addresses and domain registrars, Kent Bailey had continued chasing down international leads from SOD headquarters in Virginia. Now, with Brill and Holdren firmly establishing Paul LaRue as the target atop the organization, he started trying to build a profile of the kingpin they were dealing with. Bailey turned to a DEA analyst based in South America, whom he had come to trust in other cases, asking her to assemble a portrait of the mysterious man behind RX Limited. Despite the breadth of his operation, LaRue had managed to remain something of a ghost. Not so much as a single photo of him could be easily found on the internet. But Bailey's analyst discovered that LaRue had surfaced publicly just over a year before, in the strangest of circumstances, a July 2007 article in the American political newspaper The Hill. The story mentioned LaRue in a brief anecdote illustrating how individuals, not just organizations, were lobbying Congress for their own causes. After describing an American businessman's lobbying to avoid government regulation on his Texas property, the reporters turned to LaRue. "Another wealthy businessman is close to securing government land," they wrote. "But this real estate is in Zimbabwe, and the case possesses elements of international intrigue." LaRue had reportedly hired Dickens and Madsen, a Montreal-based political consulting and lobbying firm, to pressure the American government into helping him obtain a 99-year lease on farmland in Zimbabwe. "LaRue is a wealthy businessman who was born in the nation when it was called Rhodesia," they wrote. "He now holds Australian and South African citizenship, but says he wants to set down roots in Zimbabwe." LaRue's stated aim, according to the article, was to bring white farmers back to Zimbabwe to work land they had been driven off by the administration of Robert Mugabe. A brief quote from LaRue framed the effort as a kind of reverse reparations effort for white farmers. "We want recognition that injustice was done in the past, and that the land reform program corrects that," LaRue told the reporters. The lobbyist at Dickens and Madsen was a man named Ari Ben Menashe, described as a former Israeli intelligence agent with personal ties to Mugabe. He planned to lobby Congress, and possibly the White House, in an effort to bring LaRue's plans to fruition. What had come of the land effort wasn't clear, but the article at least provided Bailey and his analysts with some basic background on their target. When Bailey's analysts finally unearthed a photo of LaRue, they weren't sure what to make of him. He had been captured by a camera while passing through U.S. Customs on the island of Guam, making a flight connection. He didn't exactly look the part of an international criminal mogul, a heavyset man with dyed blonde hair, traveling in a t-shirt and shorts. The DEA analyst eventually turned up a second photo, buried in the newsletter of the exclusive Manila Polo Club, patronized by the city's wealthy and powerful. Pictured with his wife, a Dutch woman of Chinese descent named Lillian, he was identified in the caption as an online commerce entrepreneur. Beyond that, LaRue remained a cipher. In mid-2008, however, Bailey lucked into a tip. An employee inside a major bank in Hong Kong happened to notice a series of suspicious bank transfers between generic-sounding companies with names like GX Port, Vishnu Limited, East Asia Escrow, Southern Ace, Ajax Technology, and Quantcom Commerce, and 10 pharmacies inside the United States. The tipster passed the information to the Hong Kong Drug Enforcement Division, which forwarded it to the Hong Kong Office of the American DEA. Eventually, it found its way onto Bailey's desk in Virginia. Immediately, he knew that he was looking at the financial skeleton of LaRue's organization. "We had identified the vast majority of those pharmacies through the RX Limited shipping account," Bailey said. 9 of those 10 pharmacies were a hit. For the first time, they had a window into the organization's bank accounts. To open it, the investigators needed legal backup. Most DEA investigations, when they begin to bear fruit, are placed in the hands of a federal prosecutor from the closest U.S. attorney's office. For Brill and Holdren, that office was a few blocks away, in downtown Minneapolis. They had enlisted an attorney there to file for their initial court-ordered search warrants. But when offered a chance to take on the larger case, the prosecutors balked. The office had recently obtained a conviction in a case against an online pharmacy a fraction of the size of Rx Limited, and the case had been a huge resource drain. The pharmacy's owner had been represented by the prominent Minneapolis defense attorney, Joseph Friedberg. They thought it was too labor-intensive. They didn't have the expertise, Bailey said. Instead, the investigators turned to a relatively obscure section of the Department of Justice in Washington called the Consumer Protection Branch. Largely responsible for ensuring the safety of products purchased by Americans, the branch had a small office dedicated to pharmaceuticals, prosecuting cases of misbranded drugs and pharmaceutical fraud. A senior litigator there named Linda Marks agreed to take on Rx Limited. With the prosecutor on board, the investigators could now file for legal records from foreign governments, requests that had to pass through the Department of Justice. They issued requests for international financial records through the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN, which had standing arrangements with certain countries to share information. And they sent subpoenas to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which manages the bulk of bank-to-bank wire transfers going to and from the United States through a program called Fedwire. Their first targets were the banks in Hong Kong that had been wiring money to American pharmacies and doctors. Even after everything they'd learned, when the data came back, they were shocked anew. Bailey estimated that, conservatively, Rx Limited was pulling in $250 million a year in revenues, roughly the same as Facebook. In just the Hong Kong bank accounts they'd been able to locate, LaRue was holding over $50 million in cash in accounts tied to companies like Ajax Technology and Southern Ace. The difference between what LaRue was making and how much cash he had in the bank meant that a river of money was passing through the accounts and ending up somewhere else. Where, they didn't know yet. Chapter 6. The Mercenaries. 2007 to 2009. Lachlan McConnell and the Gold. Dave Smith and a History of Violence. Felix Clausen finds a job. The Life of a LaRue Mercenary. For Paul LaRue, Hong Kong's glittering metropolis offered the perfect hub through which to transit and transform hundreds of millions of dollars in illicit proceeds. As a global financial nerve center, it was the perfect place to change his virtual cash into something more tangible, obscuring its origins. The quasi-independent Chinese city had a reputation for looking the other way when it came to cleaning money. Under Hong Kong's lax regulations, LaRue could set up an endless number of corporate shells through which to funnel the money he was extracting from the pockets of American drug consumers. Lachlan McConnell, a 50-year-old Canadian with thinning hair and a resume lined with security jobs, often found himself at the terminus of LaRue's river of cash. As one of LaRue's employees on the ground in Hong Kong, he was responsible for what those in his line of work called asset protection. It seemed like a constant stream of money coming in from the U.S., he recalled. Money turned into gold. Hundreds of bars of gold, thousands of pounds of gold, tens of millions of dollars worth of gold. Money that arrived into accounts for companies LaRue controlled, Ajax Technology, Southern Ace, East Asia Escrow, and at least two dozen others, was wired to the local subsidiary of Metalor, a Swiss precious metals dealer, to purchase gold bars. That's where McConnell's role began. From his home in Manila, he flew to Hong Kong to supervise runners who picked up the gold, along with an occasional diamond purchase, and transported it to any of several properties LaRue owned in the city. Each stash house was outfitted with a large safe. From there, the gold would often be packed in military-style black plastic trunks called pelican cases and moved to the waterfront to be loaded onto a yacht bound for the Philippines, where LaRue was based. Sometimes an entire safe might make the trip. On other occasions, the cases were driven to the airport and handed to a pilot to carry, unchecked by customs, on board LaRue's jet. McConnell didn't inquire about the destination. Lachlan McConnell was one of the players on a darker side of Paul LaRue's business, one stocked with modern soldiers of fortune, mercenaries who operated outside the digital realm in the world of atoms, metal, and flesh. Employees on any one side of LaRue's multifaceted operation were told little or nothing about those on the other. For people like Moran Oz, who subsisted in the virtual world of Rx Limited, whispers of LaRue's other endeavors amounted to puffed-up rumors and scare stories. For the likes of McConnell, On the gold and gun side of the business, Oryx Limited was just an abstract explanation for how his boss made money. The mercenary's modus operandi was on the ground, providing the manpower and muscle for a staggering array of projects around the globe. McConnell joined LaRue's business in 2008, hired by a friend and British ex-soldier named Dave Smith, who told him only that the client was a very wealthy individual who had multiple businesses, including but not limited to the world's largest pharmacy. McConnell had lived in the Philippines for half a dozen years, bouncing around in the risk management industry, a catch-all label for everything from guarding industrial sites to personal protection for VIPs to corporate surveillance. He'd gotten his start in his native Canada, working protection details for politicians and diamond dealers, before moving to LA, where he'd provided security for the likes of Sylvester Stallone and O.J. Simpson. Although he never served in the military, McConnell was fluent enough in its lingo, mission planning, comms, that colleagues often assumed he had. He arrived in Manila in the late 1990s on a contract to oversee protection for a dam project and stayed. He'd met Dave Smith while both were working for a Manila-based security outfit. Smith left the company under acrimonious circumstances around 2005 and then resurfaced not long after in the employ of LaRue. How the job came about exactly, McConnell was never sure. But in short order, Smith had become LaRue's de facto head of security and right-hand man, and he offered to bring McConnell on board. LaRue wasn't just looking for people to help him wash his money, he was looking to expand his criminal horizons. Smith himself epitomized the kind of untethered international mercenary he would soon hire to fill LaRue's ranks. He hailed from Northern Ireland and had served in the British military. Often he claimed to have been a member of the Special Air Services, an elite special forces unit. "I was in the regiment," he would say, employing the SAS shorthand. Some LaRue employees doubted it, but Smith at least carried himself like a well-trained military officer, and his work history seemed to back it up. So too did the scars crisscrossing his upper torso, which he said he'd gotten fighting in the Falklands War. He'd spent time in the United States, where he married an American, working as a SWAT team trainer in Boston. "Dave bred loyalty," said Scott Stammers, another contractor Smith brought into LaRue's organization. "I kicked down doors with Dave. Dave had two sayings, train how you fight and smooth is fast." In the late 90s, Smith joined the security contracting circuit, working for a series of unusual clients. In 1998, he surfaced in Liberia as a military advisor to Charles Taylor, the country's notorious warlord president. Smith grew particularly close to Taylor's son, Chucky, mentoring him in combat strategy as the younger Taylor worked to build his own independent military force. After the unit was involved in the slaughter of a rival political group, Smith disappeared from the country. Charles Taylor was later convicted of crimes against humanity by an international court in The Hague, while Chucky landed in an American prison, convicted of torture. A few years later, Smith turned up in Iraq as a contractor for Crucible, a United Kingdom-based outfit filling one of the countless security gaps opened by the American invasion. "The difference between a contractor and a military guy is I'm getting paid five times as much," Smith told Esquire in a 2004 story on contractors working in Iraq. "And I can tell you to get fucked if I don't want to do it." Along the way, Smith had left his wife and relocated to Manila, where he eventually quit the war zones and started working for Paul LaRue. Smith's nominal job was head of security, charged with hiring muscle like McConnell and using it to project his boss's authority. But the scope of duties sometimes felt limitless. McConnell's first task was to oversee the construction of a shooting range LaRue was building in Manila, connected to a gun shop he owned called Red, White, and Blue Arms. A month later, seemingly satisfied with McConnell's work, Smith began dispatching him on international missions. "Dave gave me instructions on what needed to be done," McConnell said. "It was pretty harmless stuff, good money, working for a rich guy." LaRue had enlisted what he called dummies, family members and associates with clean criminal records he could use as proxies to register his companies under their own names or open bank accounts. McConnell's job was to keep an eye on the dummies and make sure they went where they were told. Most were Filipino, but LaRue also counted among his dummies an out-of-work Zimbabwean named Robson Tandenai and an elderly South African man named Edgar Van Tonder. "It was just babysitting," McConnell said. McConnell was soon trusted enough to take orders directly from LaRue, whom he found to be overbearing but otherwise tolerable. "He was impatient in emails, strict," McConnell said. He would say, "This is a fuck-up. Do what you can to straighten people out." Two or three times he sent me an email to say, "You can't do it this way or that way," or "Hurry up." He wanted things bang, bang, bang. He micromanaged everything. Occasionally, they would meet face-to-face in Manila, and at first McConnell saw little in LaRue's demeanor to raise alarms. "I found him to be a really nice guy," he said. LaRue was clearly a wealthy man, but rarely seemed to flaunt it. He lived in expensive houses and exclusive areas, but he didn't live extravagantly. He would travel in flip-flops and shorts, like a bum. McConnell's Hong Kong duties eventually expanded to include obtaining and transporting gold around the city and out of it. LaRue was bringing in $6 million a week from his U.S. pharmacy operation, Smith told McConnell, and needed to convert it to hard assets. Initially, Paul's thought was to hire a company like Brink's to pick up the gold and move it around, McConnell said. I said, let's go low profile and move it ourselves. McConnell wasn't oblivious to the fact that he was, at the least, working for someone operating on the edge of the law. The tentacles of LaRue's empire spread so far that he couldn't see their endpoints, but he knew that they included gold mining and logging projects in Africa and that his boss owned properties in Asia and Australia. There was talk of darker businesses, that some of the money flowing through Hong Kong was being laundered on behalf of Colombian or Brazilian cartels, or that LaRue was involved in hardcore drug trafficking himself. I did know what I was getting into when I started, in terms of the secrecy involved and the precious cargo being moved, McConnell said. I'm not a stupid person. In some ways, there were things that were probably illegal, but I didn't really pay attention. He kept everything so compartmentalized. I heard rumors, but I didn't consider them to be valid without 100% proof. Some combination of financial necessity and geographical proximity explained why most people drifted into LaRue's organization, often with little conception of the devil's bargain they were making by signing up. So it was with Felix Claus.